recap a little bit what we did. Last time we explored thinking in an effective field theory way, and the basic points are that we need to keep doing is that high energy effects, whether we know them or not, are local. So in the case of gravity, we don't know what the high energy effects are, but we know the key feature is that they'll appear local at low energies. Low energy effects, however, are non-local and are governed by the interactions and degrees of freedom that are active at low energies. We reinforce the renormalization program and made an emphasis, I'm trying to de-emphasize the infinity parts and try to emphasize the measurement or matching parts.
Yeah, very naive question. So I thought locally it means that when you have a Lagrangian,
yes,
and if all operators are evaluated at the same time, then it's local.
Yes.
So what does it mean for low energies to be non-local?
Okay, so non-local in this case will mean that if I have propagators of light particles, they propagate a relatively large distance. So when we do some quantum correction soon, we're going to have them propagating a long distance. In the case of when I was doing the vacuum polarization, if I had had massless particles in there, I would have had log q squared. Log q squared is something that, as a function, if I transform to position space, is non-local. The logarithm and the non-locality tie together in a way. Okay, the next point is also the local expansion is an expansion in energy, like derivatives, powers of derivatives look like derivatives of delta functions, so they're local stuff. So we'll see in the calculation that the local Lagrangians can be differentiated from the effects of long distance propagation by the looking for logarithms and square roots and things like that. Okay, if you don't, good. Yes?
Excuse me, since yesterday we've been talking about these local Lagrangians,
yeah,
local terms.
Yes.
I think I don't fully understand,
okay,
the difference between local and non-local Lagrangians.
Okay, so in a Lagrangian, the starting Lagrangians that we're using are always just local. They are themselves local. But the interactions there that they generate, if they involve light particles, those light particles themselves have non-local effects in that they can propagate. And so a particle that's produced over here can interact over there because it can propagate over, interact, and come back. Maybe these things are going to get elucidated a little bit better, so I'll keep the question, both those questions in mind as I go through the actual calculation, and you'll see the difference, I hope. If you don't see it after, I'm going to discuss the non-relativistic potential in somewhat gory detail, and if you don't see the differences at that stage, ask again, please. Okay? Good. Good. The example that's closest to gravity is this one where we did the sigma model, where the light degrees of freedom, which are called pions, are expressed in this form with an exponential representation here. The Lagrangians here are totally non-renormalizable in the classic sense of non-renormalization, because they involve all powers of the fields, not just a small number of powers of the fields. And high powers of the fields come with inverse powers of masses. V carries the power of a mass. Pi carries the power. Fields carry the power of a mass. The V does also. And so this is totally non-renormalizable in the classic sense. One thing I didn't emphasize when I was talking, and I wish I had, was that, the I had to put a subscript on the path integral that says lambda equals m sigma, which basically is implying that this is only allowed to be applied in a certain region. So lambda is the limit of the region where it's allowed to be applied, and it can't be applied beyond the mass of the sigma, because then I'd produce the sigma. So the sigma would be dynamical, or whatever the particle is. So there's some limit where this is allowed to be applied. That's crucial for what we're doing. The other thing that's worth emphasizing is that we have, in this process, we renormalize this theory. And so we've renormalized a non-renormalizable theory. And the non-renormalizable naming is a historic relic that's unfortunate. It makes it sound like you can't renormalize it. You can. The divergences, the high energy behavior, are local. If you have a local Lagrangian that's general enough, you'll always find a counterterm for the divergences or whatever you have, the high energy behavior. And so you can renormalize these theories. Where the non-renormalizable goes in is in this discussion that I gave of the energy expansion, that at one loop I needed to renormalize these two coefficients that you see there. At two loops I have some others, three loops I'll have some others. And so the complexity of the theory grows perturbatively with loops. But if I'm working to some finite accuracy, it's just becomes a standard field theory. And these are used in real experiments, in real comparisons with experiments. Yeah?
We do not lose our control or approximation.
No, it's actually a very controlled approximation, because you can put error bars on the stuff that you don't know. You don't know the next order in this energy expansion, or the next, and but you can give an error bar to that, because you know that it's an expansion in energy squared over some scale squared. You've measured that scale. That gives you your error bar.
In the RG sense, the perturbation does not flow into a strong field.
So at very high energies, we enter strong coupling and everything falls apart. And so that will be, at the end of this, I'll talk about the limits of the calculation, but certainly high energy, it fails. It's going to fail.
Thank you.
Sure. In the calculation we did, I want to point out those logs. In some sense, these terms were given by matching to the full theory. They're in some sense predictions. It tells you what the behavior is, and you can use those numbers in other reactions also. But the real predictions here, this had to come out exactly like the full theory, without any parameters, without anything. And the reason that has to happen is that those logarithms do come from this low energy propagation. They're not sensitive to the high energy effects. They're purely low energy. And so those are predictions. There's a lot more to this, and so I'll advertise the dynamics of the Stannard model, which you all own now, and Cliff's book, which Cliff has a book, an excellent book on effective field theories.
Checks in the mail.
Yes, thank you. You're welcome. I get reimbursed. She was good. Thanks. So today's goal is to complete this. Basically, we have trying to do the same thing with general relativity, that it sits in the path integral for the Stannard model, and the metric degrees of freedom are quantum degrees of freedom, just like before, and to illustrate these effective field theory techniques. I have two things I need to build up before I'm really set to go into that. And the first is background field method for gravity. It's actually simple. Um, And it basically doesn't amount to much more than G-mu-nu. The expansion G-mu-nu is some background field plus a quantum field that fluctuates around it. And if I do expansions, I do, let's say the connection is the background field connection plus the first order term, which I'll do by putting a bar under it, plus dot, 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 et cetera. You can do this expansion. And the only things I do want to say about it as a technique is that we maintain the background gauge invariance. Okay. Which means that since we construct objects raising and lowering with the background metric, the expansions naturally come out using covariant derivatives and background metrics. So, for example, the first order term in the expansion of the connection is the background metric to the first G mu sigma, and then I get covariant derivatives H sigma nu plus dot dot dot. So it's covariant with respect to the background gauge symmetry. That's important because then once I integrate out the quantum field, I'll have results that are generally covariant. So I get general covariance being preserved. The other thing is that there is also a gauge invariance for the fluctuation. For H. And that is just like we had in the free field case. H prime mu nu is H mu nu plus D bar mu some gauge parameter C nu plus D bar nu some gauge parameter C nu. Those were regular derivatives before, now they're covariant derivatives. But that's just generalizing the gauge invariance that we had before. Yes?
Here, when we do this on this background,
yeah.
So the idea is that this H mu nu is a small perturbation.
Yes.
And at the same time, if we're doing quantum physics, we will do a perturbation for that thing.
Right.
How can we know the orders of magnitude we need to consider for like one loop, two loops, but at the same time, we're already doing a perturbation in the field?
Well, you can do the calculation and see if the correction's small. I mean, one way to do it is just to try it and see how it works out. If your corrections are small, your perturbation has been small.
Okay.
Yes?
Is this applicable for the case that background is time dependent?
In principle. I mean, in practice, what we're going to do is we're going to make this, we're going to renormalize the theory in a general background. And then I'm going to do my calculations in flat space because that's where I know how to live. Okay. If you wanted me to do it in a time-dependent background, I would use it in formulations, and I would do what things I know how to do, and I know how to do some calculations in time-dependent backgrounds. But we all struggle with that as a subject. But it's no different than other theories in that case is trying to do time-dependent problems is just a challenge for quantum field theory.
And what guarantees that if we have started from the background at t equal zero, the perturbation will remain small at t equal zero?
Yeah, no, let's come back to that. I think it's not guaranteed at all, really. Okay, one of the things I'll say at the end is that gravitational effects build up, and so time-wise it could happen. I'm going to talk about it spatially, but nevertheless, time-wise is also the same thing. There's no guarantee. That will delimitate the limits of our calculation. So we can calculate in some physical settings. As we leave those settings, we can't calculate. Okay, so, and the good thing about effective field theory is it doesn't pretend to calculate everything. It pretends to calculate something somewhere, and we do what we can. Okay? Any other questions before I sneak along? Okay. The gauge fixing constraint. Is the equivalent of harmonic gauge, but with a covariant background. So there's some constraint, which is d bar mu h mu nu minus d bar nu h lambda lambda. That's the constraint that's set equal to zero. And the gauge fixing term that you'd add to the Lagrangian is 1/2 c nu c nu. Okay. So again, just a generalization. Well, this is going to be interesting. That particular formula is going to be interesting when we do ghosts, which is our next topic. Okay, so at this stage, you have a background field expansion, which I'm not going to say too much more about. But I'll use it when I do the ghosts. So ghosts. Ready for ghosts, everybody? Okay. So at the heart of this is that you need to, if you have external degrees of freedom for the gauge fields, you can limit this to the physical ones. If you are doing something like with loops, there naturally are, even in a gauge fixed setting, unphysical degrees of freedom that propagate in loops. And the idea of ghosts is to take out those. Well, these are supposed to be dots by subtracting out the ghosts to make this physical. And at this stage, what I'd like to do is I'd like to tell ghost stories. And I do this by going to Feynman. This is a paper of Richard Feynman's from 1963, you can see that there. It's a beautiful, beautiful paper. You should read it. It's linked on the website. One of the fun things about it is that he didn't actually physically write it. It was transcribed from his talk because he was too lazy to write it. But it then comes across in Feynman's voice, which is better than having a formal written paper. But in it, he announces two major things. One is he announces what's called Feynman's tree theorem. And then the other is he quantizes gravity. So no big deal. Here's the tree theorem. He says, I discovered a number of theorems relate closed loops to diagrams without closed loops. And you come down here. You can express any diagram with a circuits, closed loops, in terms of diagrams of only trees, and all the momentum of trees are on shell. Okay? That's actually a powerful theorem. It says that all loop diagrams are determined by on shell physical amplitudes. This has become a modern technique. This is the unitarity-based techniques. You calculate on-shell amplitudes, and you suddenly have the whole Feynman diagram expansion. Okay, so it's a subfield which I I think is a beautiful subfield. It's Feynman's tree theorem. That's his announcement of it. But then applying that, he's going to try to play with that in doing gravity. He finds a trouble. He doesn't get the same answer by doing it by Feynman diagrams and by doing it by his tree theorem. He then notes that Yang Mills has this theory also. So he was heartened by the fact that not only did gravity have it, gravity wasn't alone in this difficulty. Yang Mills was also having it, made him think it's not just a property of gravity, that you should, it's a property of other theories. Then how do you cure it? So he uses it in reverse. He says the tree theorem has to be true because that's unitarity. So there must be something that I have to do to change the usual Feynman diagram calculations. And of course, since he's Feynman, he's allowed to do that. So he does it in a typical Feynman way by inventing something that sounds crazy. Instead, he calculates with a different particle going around, an artificial dopey particle. It's a vector particle in gravity, coupled to the field, that corrects it. In the audience is sitting Bryce DeWitt, who's not quite as loosey-goosey as Feynman. And so he says, with this tricky extra particle, can you tell us a little bit more about it? And Feynman says, sure, give me 10 minutes and I'll show you I can do math in a way that nobody can understand. But he basically, this is him passing on the information to DeWitt. DeWitt takes it, goes home, and figures out the Fadeev-Popov trick. Fadeev-Popov find it independently, presumably. Wrong button. Let's see, there I am. I want to get back to the lecture. So what I'm going to do is I will paste those in here. And then we'll just continue after the lecture's over so that you have a record of those. But the link is there on the paper there. Anyhow, but I want to just show you a little bit about the technique. This is one that almost nobody carries in their head. If I asked someone to stand up and derive the Fadeev-Popov ghosts, I doubt anyone, myself included, if I hadn't just reviewed it, could do that. So here's the logic, and I'll just skim it over. So let's write one in a very fancy way. The number one can be written as the integral dx delta function of f of x times derivative of f respect to x. Okay, that's the definition of delta functions. And if I had many variables, these would be function of many variables, and this becomes the determinant. Okay. So what DeWitt does is he inserts one into the path integral in a way where the delta function imposes the gauge constraint, and he has to deal with the leftover pieces here. So in the path integral, it's the one is written as integral over, let's just do a single gauge transformation, delta function of some function of the fields, which imposes the constraint, and then the determinant of df d theta. Theta now is the sum of these xi's. Okay? Now, I can do all the steps, and they're all in various places. This imposes the constraint. This can be factored out, and this is basically a volume of the gauge. And then you factor an infinity out of the calculation. The interesting piece that gives you the ghosts is this delta function. And So the Feynman, DeWitt, Fadeyev, Popov trick is basically to say, well, I know how to do a fermionic path integral is a determinant. So the determinant of f df d theta, that's some function, is the integral over fermions dc, dc bar, these are the ghosts, e to the I integral d4x c bar partial f partial theta c. Okay, so this is a path integral result that the determinant raised to the positive power is a fermionic determinant. And then that's where you get the ghosts, these fields. And then we just look at what this constraint is. So let's say for QED,
excuse me.
Yes?
Would that determinant be basically a propagator?
Well, it's sort of like a kinetic energy piece plus interactions. Okay, you'll see it in just a second because I'm going to show them for QED, for QCD, and gravity. Okay, in QED, our constraint is our gauge invariance. So A of theta is A mu plus D mu theta. Okay. The constraint f of a of theta is that the get the derivative of a mu equals zero. And so then the derivative of a mu of theta, the theta dependence, is box theta, okay, because it's the derivative of the derivative of theta. And so this df d theta is box, the ghost Lagrangian is c bar box c. And that has no interactions in it, so I can just factor it out. So let me say one thing first. So this is why in QED you don't need ghosts. In QED, the gauge constraint is such that you don't need to, you can just integrate the ghost Lagrangian out. Yes, question.
Yeah, at this layer, we are not saying anything about theta c and c bar, like Grassmannian objects or something.
Yeah, they're fermions, they're Grassmannian objects. Yeah, so yes. By saying fermions, I'm assuming that in the path integral, they're Grassmannian objects.
Thank you.
Sure. In QCD, I won't do it exactly, but the c's carry the color index. Because the constraint carries a color index, and df d fa d theta b is delta a b box, but then there's a g f a b c d mu a mu C. Okay, so this is what sits in the ghost Lagrangian, and now there's an interaction, and you need to have it. For gravity, in this particular gauge, harmonic gauge, this is my constraint, I'm sorry. This is capital. Let me call it F. No, actually, d mu, that's nu, mu h mu nu minus 1 half d mu h lambda lambda. And the, if you remembered, let me not write it again, but I gave you the gauge condition. So if I change the gauge, I add that piece to it. So when I take the equivalent change in the constraints, so F nu is D bar nu on D bar nu H, or I'm sorry, C mu plus D bar mu C nu. So that's the variation on this term here. And the other one is I had a half. The trace has, there's two terms in that shift, and it's D bar mu D nu bar C nu.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just a bit confused about the indices here.
Yeah. Let me let you be confused. Okay. I'm also trying to, I'm looking down here and I'm trying to remember what I wrote up here. Okay. And I've changed notations on you in the between because I've changed C to F. Since I'm copying from my notes, they're pristine. Okay. This is the, and you know, really, my goal here is to get you, give you a sense of where this comes from. It's coming from the determinant, and let me just then, the thing I wanted to point out, the only thing I need to point out is that there's a commutator here. This term, and this term, and that term are reversed. Commutators of covariant derivatives give R. This thing ends up being d squared, d bar squared on c nu plus r mu nu on c nu, or mu, sorry. And the Gauss Lagrangian then, I have two indices, mu and nu. The variation of the function nu with respect to c mu is g mu nu d bar squared plus r mu nu. R, and that's the background field. Okay, and that's then the Lagrangian. Here, then the Gauss Lagrangian is, it's a vector field because it has these vector indices. So like Feynman said, it's a vector field, eta mu, eta bar mu. It's g bar mu nu, g bar squared, plus r mu nu, eta nu. You don't really need to know these details, but I wanted to give you the sense of where it comes from. And there's a new Feynman rule. If I have this Gauss fields propagating, which starts off minus I times, this is k mu, k nu, eta, alpha beta plus dot dot dot. So it's got two derivatives because there's two derivatives there, there's two derivatives there. And I'll paste that also in later so that you can see what it looks like. But we're never going to use it.
Is this R mu nu or this is R mu nu bar?
This is R mu nu bar. Yes, background.
So it doesn't take down derivatives of H?
No, no, it involves just the background field. So this is an independent field from H now. So it's a new field. It's also in the path integral, blah, blah, blah.
So we only get the two derivatives from the d squared term.
There's also two derivatives in here.
But they're the two derivatives of the background field.
They're two derivatives of the background field, yes. Okay, so that's that. All right, so now we've done all our construction. We've got our Lagrangian, we've got our everything. So now let's do the EFT. Okay. The important ingredients for the effective field theory are the symmetries and the active degrees of freedom. In this case, it's the gravitons, and the symmetries is the general covariance. So we write out a general action consistent with these symmetries and involving these fields. We know that the first term can be the cosmological constant. The second term can be Einstein's term. If we're willing to go to higher derivatives, I can have curvature squared. And there are two terms I can do here, r mu nu. There'll be higher terms, more terms here. There's actually only two terms here in four dimensions. The Gauss-Bonnet invariant is G is R mu nu alpha beta, R mu nu alpha beta, minus 4 R mu nu, plus R squared is the total derivative. And so the integral over this overall, it's a total derivative, it just depends on boundaries. That integral is the Euler characteristic of the manifold. And so we will, in our formulation here, not included, it can be just treat it as a total derivative.
Oh, excuse me. But how can the ghost enter in the loops if it's coupled with the back?
Okay, so this is a good point. What we do is I can do two things. I know the ghost has to be there. I have it in terms of the background. I can we treat the background as the external fields, whatever external fields there are. So coupling to the background also means coupling to external gravitons.
So it's as if we are expanding.
So just like the term R there will describe external gravitons, the term that has the ghost with an R will describe the coupling to an external graviton. We wouldn't, and so then I'll have it in loops and then another external graviton. Okay, so that's the point. There was another question. Yeah.
One question, I'm not sure, but are we interested in including the Weyl tensor contracted form?
So there's two terms. One common way to do it is these two because they look simple. The better way really is to do R squared and Weyl squared.
Yeah.
That's equivalent by just playing with the Gauss-Bonnet term. I don't do it here just because I then have to explain what the Weyl tensor is and its properties and all that sort of stuff. But when I do these things in practice, I tend to use the Weyl tensor as the second operator. Okay, so effective field theory doesn't tell me what those constants are. I have to go out and measure them. So we know the following. It doesn't tell me anything useful about the cosmological constant. We just go out and measure it. It's 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power. I will then neglect it. On scales where I feel I can do the calculation, that's negligible. Kappa squared is 32 pi g. We've sort of said that already. That's given by the Newtonian interaction. And C1 and C2, I should go out and measure. Well, good luck with that. These are dimensionless numbers because the curvature squared is dimension 4. If they were truly enormous, they might have some effect. And so if you allow them to be truly enormous and treat them not as perturbations but as big things, you can get some bounds on it. The bounds that I'm about to quote come from millimeter. Gravity experiments. In other words, they'd influence things on small scales. But they'd only influence them if these things were bigger than 10 to the plus 65. Okay? So if we're expecting to be of order unity, we have that bound. So in my renormalization as a measurement scheme, I'd have to actually go out and measure it. Fortunately, I'll quote you things that don't depend on those numbers. Okay? And so that are completely independent of those numbers. Okay. So there's my starting Lagrangian. A thing that I have to do along the way is I have to renormalize. And to an effective field theorist, this is the most boring step, because we all know that the high energy behavior of the effective field theory is wrong. It just doesn't have any correspondence to reality because it's not valid there. And so the divergences that I get, the numbers, don't have any correspondence to reality either. But nevertheless, it's a step in the calculation that I have to do. I do a loop, I find some divergences, I absorb them into various constants that I then go out to measure or pretend to measure or match. This stage, I'd remind you on the scalar loop that we did. At one stage, I gave you the Feynman rule where we have scalars coming in. Now we have gravitons hooked up to scalars. I did that diagram for you. And I showed you that this, by power counting, this went like 4 powers of momentum. Arranged in various combinations. This by itself tells me that it can't be absorbed in the curvature square, the curvature term, the Einstein term, because that has only 2 derivatives. Q factors of Q look like derivatives when I take matrix elements. So these are of order R squared terms. And at this stage, I then go back to this and I pull out my fancy techniques. I pull out background field. And I pull out heat kernel. And I let the mathematicians do their work, and I find that the A2 coefficient is 1 over 180. It's r mu nu alpha beta, r mu nu alpha beta, plus r mu nu, plus 5/2, let me just write something and I'll explain it. 6c minus 1, that scribble is a symbol, squared r squared plus minus 6 blocks are. Okay, mathematicians tell us this. This C is a coupling which I have not introduced, but it's C R phi squared, coupling in the Lagrangian. So, yeah. Anyway, this tells me that that this interaction is equivalent to a change in the Lagrangian that looks like this. So delta, the change in the Lagrangian is 1 over 16 pi squared, this A2 operator. Okay, that's essentially what I did last time. And if you actually do it in detail, it matches perturbatively all the terms in this coefficient. So each of you expand all these out in terms of the fields, and you get exactly what you get from doing the Feynman diagram expansion. So you could, I mean, you know, everyone doesn't, you don't have to rely on that calculation. You can just go ahead and do it yourself, and then pull, you can identify it. They're pretty obvious. So that's, the renormalization that comes out for a scalar loop. If I do a graviton loop, well, I don't do it. We let some powerful guys do it. And I should actually have given Tufton Veltman credit for this background field expansion in because they're the first to apply that to gravity. I mean, it existed as a technique before, but they did the steps that I did here. They do the background field expansion, they do the Gauss with gauge fixing. So all that stuff that I did is basically following their pathway, and they should, of course, get great credit for it. In this case, I'm doing graviton loops that look like that. And here's one where I have to couple in the Gauss in order to get the gauge invariant answer. This one corresponds to a change in the Lagrangian, 1 over 16 pi squared. Let me get the number right that's in front of there. Times 1 over 120 r squared plus 7 over 20 r mu nu. You don't often see sevens occurring at the output of a calculation, but there you go. And so this is actually, sorry, I forgot the 1 over epsilons. The counter terms that you have to add to the Lagrangian, the divergent pieces, carry these forms. These renormalize the coefficients in a particular way.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Weren't there other fields, like Gauss fields?
Pardon me?
Maybe I'm lost, but I thought that there were like Gauss fields to both.
No, the Gauss fields never live on the outside. They only live in loops. So if you want a formal way of saying that, is when I put that unity in there, I didn't put a source for the Gauss fields. And so there's they don't appear as external states. They appear only inside loops because they couple up to the gravitons. Okay. Yes.
With this extract, I just don't need to consider the Gauss.
I'm sorry, what?
That extra term in the Lagrangian. So I plug in.
So I've already got, I've used the Gauss to give me that number.
Okay.
So I do the graviton loops and I do this, and the sum of those gives me that as the answer. Okay, so the R's here correspond to the external gravitons, GG. Okay, in this case I'm doing black background field, so they would look like a background field at this stage, but I've integrated out the quantum Gauss and the quantum gravitons. This is the residual. Okay, this is the term you need to renormalize. And again, I could have done it straight Feynman diagrams, and people also did that. That is so bloody painful. Yeah, you saw that triple graviton coupling come squared here. Yes.
Do we have again one loop diagram at 4-point vertex here, and do we need a
constructor? You don't at one loop. You don't need the 4-point vertex.
Okay.
At two loops, you would. So I'm sort of modifying things that involved two gravitons, because that's what can generate this. So I don't need the 4-point vertex for that, thankfully.
That's a 20 under the 7?
That's what?
20 under the 7?
That's a 20 under the 7, yes.
So why is there no... So in final level theory, you get a one-loop contribution.
Yes.
So why is there no...
Why is there... Okay, so you might have said, why not that? This?
Yeah.
Okay. The answer is that in dimensional regularization, that's zero. Okay, that's a great question. Let me draw it better since we're talking about it. If you do this, this guy looks like sort of it's and so it appears, it does, actually that's right, it does appear for that, sorry, you're totally right, but it looks like d4 or ddk, some k's in the numerator, which is probably 2 powers of k in the numerator, k squared's in the denominator, but there's no external factor of anything, there's no momentum, there's no nothing. So when all scaleless integrals in dimensional regularization are set equal to zero.
That's for Masson's limit, right?
Yes, it's the Masson's limit. So all tadpoles, this is called a tadpole, all tadpoles vanish in dimensional regularization. Okay. Okay. Yes?
These generated terms are supposed to renormalize those C1 and C2.
Exactly, yes.
And again, these are unobservables?
The coefficients that they get are unobservable, but that's just a function of our present capabilities. They're in principle observable. Okay. All right. But as I said, that's the boring stuff. The renormalization, we all sort of knew ahead, well, probably back at Tuff Veltman's time, it wasn't completely known that you could do this in a gauge invariant way. They did it, but it's in the end not surprising. What I'd like to turn to now is a calculation in the effective field theory that gives a non-zero result, but which is interesting because it is sensitive to the theory in the region where it should be valid, where it is valid. Okay, so my example is the Newtonian potential. Okay, and I'm going to define this from the scattering potential, so if you're a stickler for how I define my potential, it's the potential that I get from the scattering amplitude, and we can discuss that if you want, but I won't. And it's basically the thing I did before. Really, is the scattering amplitude is the observable, the real observable, and taking it to a potential is a bit of a display trick. I'm taking, just like I did with the initial one, where I took that in the non-relativistic limit and Fourier transformed it to get the leading term in the Newtonian potential. I'll take that plus all the quantum corrections to it, take the non-relativistic limit and Fourier transform it. Okay. So I take that, the corrections, there's a lot of diagrams, so they go like that. there's the inverse of that. Let me skip some of those and I'll just write all the types of classes. There's that plus that plus, sorry, box line box diagrams plus Tufted Veltman's types of diagrams. And there's a bunch more, okay? You basically take all of them. You're required to take all of them if you want to be sure that your answer is gauge invariant. And I take the non-relativistic limit and the Fourier transform. Okay. So what am I going to find? I'm not going to do that calculation for you. It's also a pain. But the matrix element is going to look the following. It's going to look sort of like GM M over Q squared. Schematically, there's four pi, forget four pi's here, at leading order. So this is one. The next order terms in here will have various forms. There'll be a term that looks like G. It turns out to be symmetric, M plus M square root of minus Q squared. So the square roots you don't often see, but you get them here, and I'll talk about them more. So let's give that a coefficient A. B, we will get GQ squared. So that's dimensionless. GQ squared is dimensionless. I get log Q squared. Logs are my friends. And then I'll get another term, which is G times Q squared with no logs. And that's basically what I get at the expansion. Okay. These turn into various things. The first one gives me GMM over R 1. Okay. The next one, that having that, I have GM plus M. If I'm making that dimensionless, that goes like 1 over r, and that is the Fourier transform of this 1 over the square root of q squared. That's a dimensionless number in h bar equals to c equals to 1 units, actually independent of h bar. If I take the, so this q squared cancel, if I take the Fourier transform of log q squared, I get 1 over r cubed, which means a correction of g over r squared, and for that guy, leave a little space there. And then the last term, q squared over q squared, gives me a delta function. Okay, so that's short range. Okay, if I put h bars back in, h bars sit right there. This term is the classical expansion parameter. This is a quantum. So the classical expansion parameter is what you get in the post-Newtonian approximation. Expand in that power. This GH bar over R squared is a quantum dimensionless parameter, linear in H bar.
And there's a coefficient, there's the b from before?
B comes down. It's actually, you know, b over square root, or over 2 pi squared or something like that. Anyhow, you then calculate away, and you get these terms. And this is always painful for me to say because it's a difficult calculation because you have to do all those diagrams and all those vertices. You get minus gm, m over R, 1, if I do harmonic gauge, I get 3 G M plus M over R plus 41 over 10 pi squared G H bar over R squared. The delta function doesn't contribute. And there's my answer. Here's the quantum correction to the Newtonian potential that follows from effective field theory.
That was a graviton loop, right?
That was from a, you know, they're all graviton loops. The quantum piece comes from every single diagram that's on there. There's some that are just, the piece that I call the classical piece only comes from a subset of them. For example, a classical comes from that, but not from that. Yes?
All of these diagrams are one PI?
Yes. Yes?
Have we been able to measure any effect of the third term?
The third term. So no, the answer is experimentally is no, because if you put dimensions in there, g is the Planck mass. So if I turn that into a Planck scale, it's a very tiny distance scale. Distance Planck scale over r squared is the correction. We're not going to see that. Okay, I try to turn this into a positive, because when you're doing perturbation theory, you like your corrections to be small. This is the best perturbation theory known to man. Okay, it's not the worst; it's the best. Okay, so yes.
That correction does not imply violation of equivalence principle.
No. Well. Yes and no. I mean, it the equivalence principle. Yes, it probably actually does, but it doesn't imply the real equivalence principle violation. It implies the sort of non-relativistic, simple-minded equivalence principle that. That the inertial and gravitational masses are identical. It's sort of like a scale dependence. It's not, it doesn't really, because it's a different scale, R dependence. I don't know. I don't know exactly how to answer that. Let me say a few things about this. Let me skip saying a few things now. I'll come back and say them. When I think I need to really get to my time. Another calculation that I could do, and I have done, is the bending of light. Here we have a massive object, M, and we look at light coming in, or gravitons, or massless scalars. And there's a whole set of diagrams that look like that, plus many, 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 many more. There's even more than the other one. And so just to show you one here that's interesting is gamma. Gamma's gravitons up there, gravitons down here, gamma there. Or gammas could be scalars, or gammas could be gravitons themselves. We have done that, we have done it in a technique that I haven't told you about. And if I convert this to a bending angle, so this is also more than I can explain, but we use a Eichenel technique. And Eichenel is an optics technique that converts wave, basically in this case will convert amplitudes into scattering at large angles. It's a way to do with the optical limits of field theories. And I can convert this into a bending angle. In a way, I can't tell you. Gm over the impact parameter. B is the impact parameter. So I get the expected leading term. Amazingly, I get the classical subleading term, which is g m squared pi over b squared. And then I get a term that's going to be g h bar over b cubed, which is quantum mechanical. And the coefficient here, 8 times some number, which I'll tell you about, minus 47. How many times do you see 47? 64 log. This is log of b over some infrared effect, which I don't want to explain. But anyhow, it's there. Over pi, so some number. But what's interesting here is that this number, which I just called CB, is 371 over 120 for a spin zero. It's equal to 113 over 120 for a photon. It's equal to minus 29 over 8 for a graviton. Okay, so we can do these type of calculations. We can do more. I don't really have a chance to tell you more.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry, we mean spin zero photon graviton. We mean the bending of light by the
spin zero part. Yeah, so if I sent a massless spin zero particle in, it would bend one way. I send a photon in and it bends a little differently.
Oh, so it's a different particle being bent by gravity.
Yes, that's right. Different particle. So zero graviton, gamma on the massless side. Okay. Yes.
So if that diagram is allowed, what about light by light scattering? The Bunch diagram.
Yeah, there's
can you calculate that? Still effective field theory.
So there would be, there is a, I mean, in this case, there's a box diagram. I'm not sure if it's the one that you're after. There's
gone.
One that looks like this.
Yeah.
That's there.
What about if I have another gamma down there?
Connecting down to the bottom, we're right down here?
Yeah.
Okay, well.
Box diagram. Instead of solid light, instead of matter field. Can I?
Oh, you're doing that?
Yeah.
That can be done too.
Okay.
I don't know if it's been done for real photons out there, but it's been done for massless particles with gravitons like that. Okay. That's been done. Dunbar and Norridge is the quote on that. And that also has some interesting things, like I can say. There are other things like this that exist in the literature. I can't do them. So what we find here is that we're able to calculate these very small effects, but nevertheless they're reliably calculated using effective field theory in limits where these corrections are small and well defined. I want to talk about them I'm going to move into a little discussion. Where I just say various things about it. The potential correction is universal, which means that if the particles are mass are spin zero, spin one, spin a half, the moon, it's the same for everybody. And this isn't obvious to begin with, and it was found rather painfully by my colleagues Holstein and Ross, who just started calculating away different spins, and they always got the same answer. And the proof of this comes in two things. We have redone the calculation using the tree theorem. Okay, so in other words, the calculation is basically that if I take on shell gravitons. And just multiply them together the way Feynman tells us to do in the tree theorem, you get the same answer. Okay. That's one ingredient. The other ingredient is that on-shell amplitudes satisfy soft theorems. For tree level. Okay, these go back to Weinberg, Jakief and Gross, I should have put Low up in first because the first one was done for photons by Low, but basically gauge invariance and not much else constrains the couplings of these amplitudes at low wavelengths, which would hold even if that's the moon that you're talking about, as long as your wavelengths are small compared to the radius of the moon, big compared to the radius of the moon. And so by the fact that I can combine the tree theorem and these soft theorems, I get a soft theorem for this potential. That's going by a little quick, but let's move on. The second thing that is worth noting there is that classical effects come out from one loop. Okay. And so most of you were probably taught when you were taught field theory that the loop expansion is the H-bar expansion. And that's not true. And you can see it because I've done one loop diagrams and I've got classical results out. Those classical results match the post-Newtonian expansion of the classical theory done classically. So that these are genuine effects. The flaw is the following. The flaw is that the theorem is a folk theorem, it's not a real theorem. And one way to see this is if I put h bars back in, I have h bar del slash minus m psi. That's the Dirac equation. This, when you start doing the theorem, you pull out factors of h bar and you leave behind no h bars. Except that you actually do. In various places, there are hidden factors of H-bar that are generally not accounted for. And that shows up in the calculation. I had m square root of minus q squared in my calculation. It's one loop, so I might put an H-bar in front of it, if I put H-bars back in, I get that H-bar there. I get classical effects. This is now an industry. People doing gravitational waveforms now routinely do quantum calculations, loop calculations, that give you the gravitational waveforms. It has gotten up to the state of the art in gravitational waveforms. So even people that have done it, the previous methods have started adapting it as a technique. Okay.
So, I guess so. If you set h bar to zero, some of the loop diagrams survive.
Yeah. So, the diagrams having done them, you actually can see where they come, and there is a story behind that too. They're basically diagrams like the ones I just underlined there, where you have two massless particles and a massive one, and in the loop integral you get you basically touch on the mass shell of the massive one, because the small momentum limit of that diagram hits the mass shell of that.
So is the parameter for these the metric perturbation?
Well, the metric perturbation is small, yes, it's, but...
I mean, this is an expansion in some small parameter.
Well, the expansion parameter here is gm over r. So, or in momentum space, it's this q squared. So if I'm doing a Feynman diagram calculation, it's q squared at small, and I'm looking for that square root. The square root turns out to be the giveaway. This holds beyond that too. And that's what actually happened in the bending of light too. This guy came from the square root. And this other, the other one came from the logs. I rushed past that because I have to. Okay, so that's an interesting one. The third thing is bending of light is not universal. That gravitons and photons bend differently, but this is a very small effect. So we can, if we're doing ordinary physics, correct for it. We know what we're doing, but it gets big, of course, as you get to the edge of where the effective field theory breaks down is when these corrections become big. And basically what it means is that geodesics and Penrose diagrams become uncontrolled. As I enter the deep quantum regime. So while they're great classical constructs, they probably do not survive. A fourth takeaway is that there's no quantum metric by that. I mean, one of the first things that I did, having started these calculations, is I went off to look at what's the quantum correction of Schwarzschild. I did the calculation, I have an answer. That answer is unfortunately meaningless. And the basic reason is that that's not a quantum question. Scattering amplitudes are quantum questions. And the proof of this was done by a gentleman named Kirlin, who attacked our calculation, but unfortunately correctly. And his proof was he basically redid the calculations, the same calculations, but did a field redefinition. In other words, h goes to h plus something of order h squared and gets different answers. If you remember Hogg's theorem, says that all on-shell amplitudes, all physical amplitudes are invariant under field redefinitions. So this violates it. And so this is not a great quantum calculation. But it's not that surprising. We don't ask what is the quantum electric field around an electron. You ask what's the scattering amplitude. It's because it's basically only part of the calculation. You know, the when I look back at the diagrams, if I put my putting my finger doesn't do anything to you, does it? If I took out that part of the diagram, it would look like the quantum correction to Schwarzschild. That's the ones you do for that diagram. And I wouldn't put the other ones in, and I wouldn't get something that's gauge invariant. I wouldn't get something that's reparameterization invariant. So that's also a consequence, which is unfortunate because we would all love to ask that question, and you have to find other ways to answer that question.
Yeah, you could in principle do a calculation which was a scattering.
So I can in principle do a calculation of scattering off of Schwarzschild and ask how that changes, but that's a slightly different question and much more difficult.
Is that somehow related to the bending of light question? There is a...
Well, I mean, in a sense, the bending of light question, the bending of light is Schwarzschild, where it is off Schwarzschild in a sense, because it's the far field in Schwarzschild. The interesting one would be if I had a black hole with a horizon, trying to do it close to the horizon. And that's a more difficult calculation, because then I'm out of the weak field limit in doing the calculation. But in principle, I could imagine trying.
So would you do that just setting the background field metric?
I would presumably, I'm about to come up to something that bears on that. So let's hold your question till after I say my limits. So I as a true effective field theorist, I have to talk about the limits of the effective field theory. Okay, and I have, like a true speaker, I always save the weakest parts when I run out of time. Okay, the most obvious one is that at high energies and large curvatures, it breaks down. We had the expansion R plus R squared plus R cubed, etc. If the curvature is large enough, those all become of equal order. We had amplitudes that went like, so Lagrangians go like this. Matrix elements go like E squared plus E to the fourth plus E to the sixth plus dot, dot, dot. Energies get high enough. And of course, the scale here is the Planck scale. So all this has to break down at the Planck scale. As an effective field theory, there's no way it could go beyond that. It could break down earlier. Something could happen that this is not the correct theory earlier. We could have open up extra dimensions or whatever. It can break down earlier, but it has to break down at this stage. That's okay. That's what every effective field theory does. I do want to say a little bit about how this is a little different than other effective field theories in that there are potential infrared limits. One is the problem or the issue that gravitational effects build up. And so the classic example of this is that if I'm far from a black hole, I'm almost flat. As I move into the black hole, I'm in regions of very big black hole. I'm small curvature all the way. Small curvature at the horizon, the curvature of a big black hole has a very small curvature. But nevertheless, my metric has blown up. I started off here with a metric that's basically flat, and at the horizon, the metric functions become singular or vanish. So because of that, we have trouble describing both here and close to the surface of a black hole. If I was only interested near the surface, I could put up coordinates that are nice there. They can always go flat coordinates, almost flat. But I can't do it universally. And if I'm interested in very far infrared effects, that becomes an issue. So my favorite little thing to say at this stage is that there is a set of coordinate system where I'm flat locally. This is Riemann normal coordinates. And they looks like the following. Alpha, beta. So this is at x prime, at x prime minus x alpha, x prime minus x beta. In other words, what you see here is that I can always choose a coordinate system that's locally flat, but as I move further and further away, if there's any curvature at all, eventually I can go far enough away that the metric functions become bigger. Okay, this may or may not be is a technical issue. But it certainly at least is that. Maybe it's more significant than that. There's the ultimate version of this is black holes. If I have a black hole and I'm doing far infrared of physics where I'm looking at, let's say, the potential between two distant points, I'm supposed to sum over all paths. Some of those paths fall into a black hole. What happens then? This, again, it's not something that we know how to deal with. So there could be issues associated with infrared physics that we just don't know how to deal with, don't know how to answer. So I always say it works at ordinary scales and maybe fails, certainly fails at high energies, and the infrared we don't know.
So this, I guess, if in terms of like a technical issue, these will be some integrals over the manifold.
Right.
So then in the regions where the coordinates blow up,
yeah,
you would just in the quotation marks, do the integral in coordinates of that region.
Well, so one thought on doing this is that you break the region up into domains, and in each domain you choose a different set of coordinates.
Yeah, so you
and then you match coordinates.
You do a match. Charts on the manifold.
Right. And so that makes you think it might be a technical issue, because I could imagine doing that. But no one's done it, so I don't know if it's a problem. You know, does the quantum effect from over here, when I match at the boundary, does it also get bigger in a controlled or uncontrolled way? And then I match the next one, does it grow again? Until it's done, I don't know. But it's one of these things that I'd like to have the opportunity to sit down and try to do it myself. Yes?
How do you get Hawking radiation from this format?
Oh, you can. I look up at Cliff, because Cliff is always my favorite example on this one. Cliff.
That's actually my second question.
Yeah.
That was going to be my
See, I have a space here. Hawking. My favorite answer to that is Hamley and Burgess. Cliff, you owe me more money. But why I like it is it has this feel that it fits into effective field theory. And it feels like a field theory calculation. And the calculation runs roughly as following. I'm doing it from memory, so that the flux is, if you look at the energy and momentum of particles, the flux, the flow of energy, is the time-space component of the energy-momentum tensor. So if I look at the time, the energy-momentum tensor in the radial direction, its time component, that tells me how energy is flowing in the radial direction. And you can get that from, if I have fields, phi of x, phi of x prime. So that's a field living in Schwarzschild. And I take the time derivative and the radial derivative, and I take the limit x goes to x prime. And that seems to me like a field theory calculation that I would think I can trust. Cliff did it, and the answer is he gets Hawking. Okay. Do you have anything to add to that comment?
Did
I summarize it okay?
Yeah.
But is this, So is this the scalar field on Schwarzschild or on the...
On Schwarzschild. On Schwarzschild, yeah.
Because in the standard derivation, you need the time-dependent collapsing space-time.
No. This is on static Schwarzschild.
So how do you get particle production on a static space-time?
Well, that's what Hawking does.
Constant electric field.
Normally
there's a... You can either phrase it in coordinates where you have a smooth geometry, but it's time-dependent, so you have particle production, or if you've got a static geometry, the Hamiltonian is unbounded below in that system.
Okay.
So in the black hole case, it's the interior that has negative energies, and in the constant electric field case, it's the you get as much energy as you like by separating charge particles.
Okay, so yeah, so that has a nice positive answer that seems to me to be trustworthy in the effective field theory framework. And then I just have two more points I just wanted to write down. The question of limits is we have to know how to ask good quantum questions. And we know how to do scattering amplitudes in field theory, effective field theories we can do. But as I explained with the Schwarzschild solutions, the some of the things that we might like to do are not good quantum questions that don't have good answers. So if some of the things you might want to ask this theory, we don't know how to do it at present. It may just be a limitation on our QFT knowledge. And then as an effective field theorist, I have to look and see what else could go wrong. Quantum mechanics could also go wrong at some scale. There's a frontier to quantum mechanics that in some senses, macros. I can't spell it in front of people. Macroscopicity. Okay, quantum mechanics is done at small scales, and we have limits. We have now experiments where you try pushing larger and larger systems. It easily could be that as the systems get larger, there is some feature of quantum mechanics that decoheres the wave functions, tells me the field theory needs modifications. So that's certainly a frontier where we don't know what we're doing. There's no reason to suspect that quantum mechanics breaks down, but there's a lot of people who feel that it should. So it's worth listing that as a limit. Okay, so let me just summarize briefly. I'm a bit over time, but my point in this has been that we've always had the been told that quantum mechanics and general relativity are incompatible. That's at very best misleading. It's easy to say, use the word false, but certainly misleading. We've seen that they go together in just the same way that other field theories, even non-renormalizable field theories are applied in the real world. And so there's a domain of validity where quantum mechanics and general relativity match up just lovely. But there's no reason to be misleading. Quantum gravity is fascinating. It's probably the most fascinating field theory around as a field theory. It's fascinating because we know gravity exists and we have boundaries on what we can know. We have these limits. The theory is only good in certain limits. And so there's no reason to be misleading. It's valuable to work on the questions of quantum gravity. But the old phrasing of the problem about the incompatibility is just not correct. Okay, good. So let me end there.